Chapter 45. Marco, we strolled along in a sufficiently indolent fashion now, and talked. We must dispose of about the amount of time it ought to take to go to the little hamlet of Ablasser and put justice on the track of those murderers, and get back home again. And meantime I had an auxiliary interest which had never paled yet, never lost its novelty for me, since I had been in Arthur's kingdom. The behavior born of nice, and exact subdivisions of caste of chance passers-by toward each other. Toward the shaven monk who trudged along with his cowl tilted back, and the sweat washing down his fat jowls, the coal burner was deeply reverent. To the gentleman he was abject. With the small farmer and the free mechanic he was cordial and gossipy. And when a slave passed by with a countenance respectfully lowered, this chap's nose was in the air, he couldn't even see him. Well, there are times when one would like to hang the whole human race and finish the farce. Presently we struck an incident. A small mob of half-naked boys and girls came tearing out of the woods, scared and shrieking. The eldest among them were not more than 12 or 14 years old. They implored help, but they were so beside themselves that we couldn't make out what the matter was. However, we plunged into the wood, they scurrying in the lead, and the trouble was quickly revealed. They had hanged a little fellow with a bark rope, and he was kicking and struggling, in the process of choking to death. We rescued him, and fetched him around. It was some more human nature, the admiring little folk imitating their elders. They were playing mob, and had achieved a success which promised to be a good deal more serious than they had bargained for. It was not a dull excursion for me. I managed to put in the time very well. I made various acquaintanceships, and in my quality of stranger was able to ask as many questions as I wanted to. A thing which naturally interested me, as a statesman, was the matter of wages. I picked up what I could under that head during the afternoon. A man who hasn't had much experience, and doesn't think, is apt to measure a nation's prosperity or lack of prosperity by the mere size of the prevailing wages. If the wages be high, the nation is prosperous. If low, it isn't. Which is an error. It isn't what sum you get, it's how much you can buy with it, that's the important thing. And it's that tells whether your wages are high in fact or only high in name. I could remember how it was in the time of our great civil war in the 19th century. In the North a carpenter got $3 a day, gold valuation. In the South he got 50 payable in Confederate shinplasters worth $1 a bushel. In the North a suit of overalls cost $3 a day's wages. In the South it cost 75, which was 2 days' wages. Other things were in proportion. Consequently, wages were twice as high in the North as they were in the South, because the one wage had that much more purchasing power than the other had. Yes, I made various acquaintances in the hamlet, and a thing that gratified me a good deal was to find our new coins in circulation, lots of milrays, lots of mills, lots of cents, a good many nickels, and some silver, all this among the artisans and commonalty generally. Yes, and even some gold, but that was at the bank, that is to say, the goldsmiths. I dropped in there while Marco, the son of Marco, was haggling with a shopkeeper over a quarter of a pound of salt, and asked for change for a $20 gold piece. They furnished it, that is, after they had chewed the piece, and rung it on the counter, and tried acid on it, and asked me where I got it, and who I was, and where I was from, and where I was going to, and when I expected to get there, and perhaps a couple of hundred more questions. And when they got aground, I went right on, and furnished them a lot of information voluntarily. Told them I owned a dog, and his name was Watch, and my first wife was a free will Baptist, and her grandfather was a prohibitionist, and I used to know a man who had two thumbs on each hand, and a wart on the inside of his upper lip, and died in the hope of a glorious resurrection, and so on, and so on, and so on. Till even that hungry village questioner began to look satisfied, and also a shade put out. but he had to respect a man of my financial strength, and so he didn't give me any lip, but I noticed he took it out of his underlings, which was a perfectly natural thing to do. Yes, they changed my 20, but I judged it strained the bank a little, which was a thing to be expected, for it was the same as walking into a paltry village store in the 19th century, and requiring the boss of it to change a $2,000 bill for you all of a sudden. He could do it, maybe, but at the same time he would wonder how a small farmer happened to be carrying so much money around in his pocket. Which was probably this goldsmith's thought too, for he followed me to the door, and stood there gazing after me with reverent admiration. Our new money was not only handsomely circulating, but its language was already glibly in use. That is to say, people had dropped the names of the former monies, and spoke of things as being worth so many dollars or cents or mills or milrays now. It was very gratifying. We were progressing, that was sure. I got to know several master mechanics, but about the most interesting fellow among them was the blacksmith, Dolly. He was a live man and a brisk talker, and had two journeymen and three apprentices, and was doing a raging business. In fact, he was getting rich, hand over fist, and was vastly respected. Marco was very proud of having such a man for a friend. He had taken me there ostensibly, to let me see the big establishment which bought so much of his charcoal, but really to let me see what easy and almost familiar terms he was on with this great man. Dolly and I fraternized at once. I had had just such picked men, splendid fellows, under me in the Colt Arms factory. I was bound to see more of him, so I invited him to come out to Marco's Sunday and dine with us. Marco was appalled and held his breath. And when the grandee accepted, he was so grateful that he almost forgot to be astonished at the condescension. Marco's joy was exuberant, but only for a moment. Then he grew thoughtful, then sad. And when he heard me tell Dolly I should have Dickon, the boss mason, and Smug, the boss wheelwright, out there too, the coal dust on his face turned to chalk, and he lost his grip. But I knew what was the matter with him. It was the expense. He saw ruin before him. He judged that his financial days were numbered. However, on our way to invite the others, I said, "You must allow me to have these friends come, and you must also allow me to pay the costs." His face cleared, and he said with spirit, "But not all of it, not all of it. He cannot well bear a burden like to this alone." I stopped him, and said, "Now let's understand each other on the spot, old